In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for your coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. I'm chatting today with Scott McCoy of The Minus Five. He's joined in the band by longtime collaborator Peter Buck, and their new album, Or on Penelope, is due out on Yep Rock Records on Friday, May the 30th, and it features our recent coolest song in the world, Let the Rope Hold, Cassie Lee. We'll hear a brief portion of the tune, and then I'll be back with Scott for your coolest conversations in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Listeners out on satellite radio land, it's time for our coolest conversations. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and my guest is musician and songwriter Scott McCoy. He's played in many bands, famously in REM for the second half of their 30-plus year run, but also leads bands like the Young Fresh Fellows and the Minus Five. And the latter has this week's coolest song in the world, Let the Rope Hold, Cassie Lee. It's off the band's upcoming album, Or on Penelope, and that is due out May the 30th on Yep Rock Records. Scott, my friend, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Manfred?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm happy that you've got a chance to connect and chat for a bit here. You know, a couple of years ago, I was speaking with your longtime friend, bandmate, Peter Buck, and we were talking about the band The No Ones, and that the coolest song at the time was KLIV. And my understanding is that was about you hearing music or being first introduced to rock and roll on the San Jose radio station, KLIV?
Yeah, I mean, that was basically it. I mean, I'd been, you know, introduced to the Beatles by, you know, my dad brought home a 45 from Sears Roebuck where he worked, and he brought home a single of I want to hold your hand, and I'm sure he regretted doing that for the rest of his life, but because that really kicked it off. And and you know, then by then we just moved to San Jose, California from Tucson, Arizona, and you know, that was kind of the first station that I listened to, a top 40, although I think it was top 30 then on KLIV. They had handed out these little things every week, you know, which had the top 30 songs listed. And so that was kind of my education with music. I mean, I just became rabid instantly and listening to that station. And, you know, if you go back and look at those top 30 things that they handed out, you know, it's just every song was just amazing, pretty much. You know, every kind of song was top 30 hit then. You know, it wasn't just like indie rock or whatever. It was just like everything, you know.
Well, how old were you when you were tuning in the radio then?
Well, I was like, you know, 10 from those years, from like 64 to 68 or 69 was, you know, it was, I was always listening to top 40 radio, you know, like, so KLIV was the closest and so the most dearest channel to me, but I could also get KFRC and KYA in San Francisco. And then, you know, somewhere around like 69 or something, I started switching over to the FM dial, you know, because there were KSAN and all these hipster, you know, like underground, you know, music stations where suddenly we'd get turned on to, you know, Half Moon Bay by Mott the Hoople, you know, 11 minute long song, you know, and stuff like that. So,
well, how did you find out about the FM stations? Right? Was that like in high school? So some cool dude saying, "No, man, what are you listening to that? Check this out," or what?
I don't remember how I came to happen, but just me and my friends suddenly, you know, went that direction, you know. And you know, I still listened to Top 40 in the car because, you know, the radio was always only AM radio in the car. So I'd still keep up with the current hits, but and you know, the hits were still pretty good then too, but I was really getting turned on to the wilder sounds, you know, being in San Francisco and all that too, because I grew up on, you know, when I, after the Top 40 thing, I got, you know, super into the local bands, Jefferson Airplane, Quicksilver Messenger Service, you know, and bands like that that were a little more trippy, you know.
Yeah.
But I always still loved appear a 3 minute pop song, you know. As you can tell, I'm still dealing in that with this new record. It's all 3 minute songs.
Right, you're finding a happy medium.
Yes.
Well, so the radio was it your dad bringing home the Beatles single, or was it the radio, or what was responsible for getting you to learn an instrument?
Well, you know, none of that really, because I mean, it all figured in, but I didn't even think of me as being somebody who could play music until I was like 17 or something like that. And then my sister got a little really shitty acoustic guitar from Blue Chip Stamps, which were like, you know, where you collect stamps, trading stamps from when you go to the grocery store. They give you stamps, and then you save up and you go in a little catalog and you can buy something. And she bought this Blue Chip Stamp guitar, acoustic guitar, and I started messing around with it at some point. And, you know, but I wasn't really thinking that I was going to do anything with it. You know, I mean, I never pictured myself being a musician. I just started doing it just for fun. And, you know, of course, my whole life was wrapped up in music then, but I wasn't thinking of being a musician and making a career out of it or anything like that. But, you know, gradually me and my friends started making music together just at a ridiculously inept level. and we had no dreams of rock stardom. That's for sure.
So this is when you're still in high school when that happens, when you start messing around.
Yeah.
And, was it as organized as a band, like, you know, you were trying to work up particular songs, or were we just kind of noodling around together? And
we had bands. We kind of had two bands going at the time. We had the first one really was called Vannevar Bush and His Differential Analyzers. And this was like kind of a guerrilla terrorist band. Like we were kind of uncool in the high school, so this was one where we all played instruments that we couldn't play. So like some people were playing clarinets. We had a couple of clarinet players. We had me playing trumpet. We had, we just made noise. We called them, let's do Freak Out Number 11, you know, and we would just all just go crazy, just make total noise. And we would do that like in the inner quad at school sometimes and stuff. So to get people angry with us, basically. And so that was our first band. But then there was a kind of a spinoff called Hannibal's Chorus Boys, which was the five of us who wanted to do rock music, you know, to do music that we liked. And so we would play Gloria, Jumpin' Jack Flash, Satisfaction, you know, songs that were actually, this is like probably 1972 or something. Those songs actually weren't that cool then, because they were already, people were moving on to the trippier stuff, and they looked at the mid-60s stuff as being kind of not really that cool at the time. So we were always on the cutting edge of not being cool.
Man, you were the king of nerd rock.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
That's great. Oh, so you're still, so this is still in San Jose.
Yeah.
So I know young fresh fellows began up in Seattle. What got you up to the Pacific Northwest, and how did playing music, I mean, how did this become your life?
Well, that's a good question, but I mean, Chuck Carroll who was the guy who I founded the Young Fresh Fellows with. He was in Hannibal's Chorus Boys, and he was at Saratoga High School. We were actually in Saratoga, California, a suburb of San Jose.
Okay.
And then I moved up to San Francisco, and then he was going to Sonoma State in Sonoma County. And so I moved up there, and that's when we started a band called the Sandbaggers, which was actually kind of okay. And we played a lot of shows around, you know, we played the Keg in Cloverdale, you know, all the hot spots. you know, at some point we were just kind of trying to figure out what we wanted to do with our lives. And we thought, well, we're not going to get anywhere playing music, you know, as a band, that's just not going to happen. So we thought, let's do something else. And so we came up with this idea of doing a free music magazine. They had this thing in California called BAM, Bay Area Musician or whatever. And that was kind of the first one of those kind of free handout music magazines. We thought, let's do one of those in someplace else. So Chuck drove around the country, and he thought Tucson would be a good place and Seattle would be a good place. And I was like, well, I used to live in Tucson, so let's go to Seattle. So we threw all our records and guitars in his VW van and drove to Seattle. And of course, by the time we got there, they already had a magazine. And so,
was the Rocket going then?
Yeah, the Rocket had just started. It was like the second issue was in the first bar that we went into. We got up there and we were like, ah, hell. But then we just went and talked to them, and we started kind of working with them. And we basically lived in a basement, and we bought a four track, a TAC 3340. Four-track reel-to-reel, and we started recording songs that became the first Young Fresh Fellows tape. It was just a cassette that we sent to our friends, and that was 1981 at that point. And then 3 years later, we made a record as the Young Fresh Fellows and put it out, and the rest is history.
So you're just kind of doing writing stuff, and then the band starts putting out records, and then you were touring. I mean, you were just, how would you tour, right? I mean, now there's all this sort of networking with the internet.
Oh, yeah.
You kind of have to know somebody in another town to get there, right, or not?
Yeah, we were clueless. But Conrad Uno, who was the producer and had Egg Studios and had Pop Llama Products, was his label that he started. He had the idea when we made this first record. He said, well, I'll send it. I think there's a like college stations you can send it to. And he got a list of like 30 stations, and he sent it out to them. And we got these playlists started coming back in, you know, Bloomington, Indiana, we're number one, you know, and we're like, what? And we didn't know how little that actually meant, but it seemed to us like we're, this is amazing. So, by 1985, we just said, let's just go on tour. And we called a couple of these radio stations. They would find places for us to play. And, you know, we just went, drove in a van. We rented a van, drove across to New York, played at CMJ. We got three shows at CMJ. And, you know, we didn't have any idea what we were doing. I mean, I don't think we had any guaranteed money or anything like that. And I think one of the shows in New York, I forgot to get paid, you know, just stuff like that happened. And, you know, believe me, if we were getting paid, it was $50 anyway. So, but we just did it on our own. We just kind of, just called people up and made plans and went, and we get some shows last minute, you know, like somebody saw us at Folk City in New York and they said, well, we have this radio station in New Haven. You could play there two nights from now. So, okay. So we just did that. We went out for a month and came back feeling really, really amazingly cool, actually, because it kind of worked, you know. I mean, of course, we played a lot of the shows were for hardly anybody, but some of the shows were really great too. And you know, it was the classic thing where you played in front of 30 people, and next time there might have been 33, or maybe even 100, you know. So. We just started doing that, and we just kept making music. I mean, we had a built-in recording scene because John Arduino would record us for free, so, and he put out the records. So it didn't. We just went gung ho. We were fully invested, you know.
Well, then, so it's off to rock stardom. Then,
of course, I was working in a record store at the time. I was working in a record store at the time too, full time, of course, you know, but. So then, you know, like we all had day jobs, as it were. But by 1987, we had to quit our day jobs so we could accommodate our touring schedule.
Right. So in fact, 87 is going to ask you. So that tune, Amy Grant off the Men Who Love Music, is it's like a college radio. That was kind of speaking of college radio hit. I was wondering. So this is like. Before the grunge thing is happening there, really in Seattle. But I know when that hits, like all the record labels, you know, are going to Seattle and trying to sign bands. Were you guys ever courted at that time in 87 or later on?
No, it was later when that stuff started happening. And I think it was probably, you know, early 90s was when the real feeding frenzy started in Seattle, you know, because Sub Pop was a little bit underground at first when it started. But of course, after Nirvana, everybody was going insane. And people came around, they sniffed around us because we were kind of a successful band at that point. But we didn't really fit in with the grunge thing. And, you know, we did showcases for major labels and stuff like that. But, you know,
you were too fun.
We wanted to be successful. Yeah, exactly. We were.
You're fun. You guys were fun.
We wanted to be successful. We wanted to be successful, but we didn't want to do what it took to be successful. and we were more likely to, if we knew there was somebody there from a label to look at us, then we would probably do a really ridiculous show, you know, something that would seal our fate immediately. So they'd be like, we're not getting anywhere near these guys, you know? and that was it. We really were about having fun. And it's kind of unfortunate in a way because people see the Fellows as kind of a joke sometimes, or a comedy band or whatever, which we weren't at all. I mean, we liked fun. We liked some songs that had humor in them, but you know, I take songwriting really, really seriously, actually. And, you know, so I feel like we didn't really get our full shrift, but at the same time, we kind of asked for it because we were ridiculous.
I want to, focus here for a moment because you and Peter Buck's relationship here, because I think he first becomes aware of you as, you know, through the Young Fresh Fellows. And he gave me an explanation of how you guys met and how you know each other. So I want to hear your version of that, and then I'll let you know how close the two versions are.
Well, Peter's is probably going to be more correct because he has a better memory than I do, but I do recall that he was doing a radio like an interview on KCMU. This is probably like 85, 86 or something like that in Seattle, and he mentioned the Young Fresh Fellows because he said he had bought our first record. He saw it in Luxtree or whatever and got it and really liked it. And he was talking to the DJ, and the DJ was a big fan of ours. And he said, the DJ said, oh, they've got a new single out. And Peter was like, oh, can you get it for me and bring it to the show or whatever? And so that was cool. I heard about that. I was like, wow, that's really neat. And so then I think in 86, they were playing at the Paramount in Seattle, and we had a show the same night, so we couldn't go. But I went to the Paramount beforehand and found him coming out of his tour bus, and I gave him a copy of our latest record, which I think was The Squirrels. It was our band under a different name.
Right.
Of course, because, you know, that's going to really help your career.
That's a great record, by the way. I remember that one. Yeah.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. It was all our side was we did all the hits of Johnny Kidd and the Pirates.
Yeah, Johnny Kidd and Pirate covers. Yeah,
that was pretty cool. So I gave that to him, and that's when I think we first met. And then, you know, he came out to shows. I think we played the Uptown in Athens, and he was there, and we hung out with him afterwards, and, you know, had a great time. And then, you know, that happened numerous times. And one time we went over to his house after we played it. We played the 40 Watt that time, and went to his house afterwards and had a all night, you know, record fest with him and Mike Mills and all of the fellows, and, you know, air drumming to Big Star and stuff like that, you know, just having an all night thing. And then I think it was like 5 a.m. He said, where are you guys staying? We're like, I don't know. So I was like, well, I guess you could stay here, which meant, you know, you could crash out in a chair on the floor.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like he had I'm sure lots of bands stayed there, but it wasn't like he had a set up with, like, you know, luxurious beds and everything like that. It was just like, yeah, you can stay here, which is fine with us. You know, I slept in a lot of bathtubs, you know, back then. And, so that was kind of the beginning of it. And then when he came to Seattle in, I guess, probably early 92, they were mixing Automatic for the People. They were working out there for like a month. And he called me up like the first day he got there. He said, hey, I'm in town. I'm going to be here for a while. What do you want to do? You want to go for dinner? And so we started hanging out. And then, you know, he ended up moving to Seattle, and we just started playing a lot of music together. And, and we started recording stuff that became the first Minus Five record. We didn't really know what it was going to be, but it was going to be a side project for, you know, for a psychedelic folk kind of deal. It was all my slow, sad songs that there wasn't really room for in the fellows. And so, I mean, we would put one or two of those on every record maybe, but that was about it. and I write like 10 slow bummer songs to every fun rock and roll song that I write. Cause, you know, you might relate to this. I mean, I don't know if you, because you're obviously really good at fun rock and roll songs, but it's a lot easier to write slow, sad songs for me. I mean, they come more natural anyway.
Wow. I feel it. Yeah. But to me, it's the complete opposite. It's a lot harder to come up with, because that's almost like a writing block thing. You know, it's like,
right.
The sad songs, I just get so sad. I can't move forward.
Uh-huh.
It's just hard that way.
Well, that's good. I mean, that's good for you, because you're in the right band. But I mean, I still love writing songs for the Young Fresh Fellows, you know, and we don't like get hung up on it's since we don't tour that much now, it doesn't really matter that much. And then the Minus Five started eventually becoming a band later on, which, so we started doing rock and roll songs in the Minus Five, which wasn't supposed to be the intention of it originally. We started playing more live in the Minus Five than the Young Fresh Fellows. So a lot of the fun rock and roll songs could end up on a Minus Five song, on a Minus Five set, they would all have to be in the fellows. So,
and so this, so that's a pretty interesting time. So you mentioned Peter comes out there, and they're working on the Automatic for the People at the time, and sort of the Minus Five, these other tracks, songs you've written, kind of working them up. And was it beginning with Automatic for the People that you start playing with REM, or did that come later?
It came a couple of years later, because it was when they did Monster, and they decided they were going to go on tour again, because they didn't tour for like 5 years. You know, they didn't tour on Automatic or Out of Time. And so, except for doing like promo shows that were mostly acoustic and everything like that. So they, when they were doing a big rock tour, they were gearing back up for that, and they wanted an extra person. And Peter said, he said, well, I want you to consider this, but first of all, I have to say, if it's going to take you away from the Young Fresh Fellows, I don't want you to quit the Young Fresh Fellows to be in REM or whatever like that, because I'm going to rescind the offer if it's going to wreck your band, and which was really cool. And I was like, well, the Fellows aren't really doing that much now, and so we were kind of at a little bit of a slower time, and everybody was kind of trying to figure out what's going to happen with this band. And so everybody, we were taking a little time off, and everybody was totally fine with that. Everybody was playing in other bands too. So I got the okay from them. And then I had to go and audition, you know, for REM and everything, but Peter made me feel like, oh, you're in, you know, but we have to do an audition just so the rest of the guys can agree on you. But he kind of gave me a lot of confidence that I was going to, I was going to fit in with them, and I did.
And you did, right? And so you're playing with REM for the second half of their career, and you're doing Minus Five albums at the time. So let's talk about the new album that's coming out and our coolest song. So the new album's titled "Or on Penelope," and again, our coolest song in the world this week is "Let the Rope Hold," Cassie Lee. And when I first saw, you know, the title of the album and saw the coolest song title, I thought, is this going to be nautical themed?
Well, I guess there is some. There's some of that in it.
Yeah, there's a shark tooth, you know. It's like,
yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that, because it's funny, because I was just doing an interview with somebody else, and he was saying, a lot of this record is about the sky. There's a lot of sky in it. So he was thinking of the aerial aspect. You're thinking of the nautical aspect. I think they both work for me.
Well, these tunes got like, what is it? I've written them out here. I mean, it's, I think 12, is it 12? 12 tunes on the album. Well, when did these songs come from? Are they more recent compositions or mixed with older or what? What's the story?
These are all pretty recent. They're all pretty fresh. I mean, you know, at the time, of course, they recorded now a couple years ago. But they were all, it was a real grouping of songs. I mean, there was lots of other songs involved, but these were ones that seemed like they fit together for me. And I didn't put a lot of planning into it. What I've been doing since the pandemic, when I made a lot of records, you know, with long distance, you know, doing them recording alone in my basement and then sending things out to people to play drums on and all that, you know, doing that whole modern way of making records. I made a lot of records those way. And then when we kind of finally started being able to get together again, I would just, whenever there was an opportunity when people were around, that I wanted to play with, I would just say, I would like tack on a day at the end of like we did a Filthy Friends, some Filthy Friends shows. And at the end of it, I said, can you stay for an extra day, like to Linda, you know, and before you go home? And I'd say, I'd book a day in the studio, and we would just go in and record whatever songs I threw at them without any rehearsing or anything like that, you know? And so I would just, so basically when that's kind of the way I've been recording the last few years, is whenever I get the opportunity to get people together that I want to play with, I just say, well, I book a day in the studio, and then I try to figure out if I have any songs. And I always feel like, I don't know if I've really been writing that many, but then I always go through the notebooks and the, the phone the voice memos, and I find, oh yeah, that's pretty good, and that's pretty good, and you know, so I just kind of finish up or complete or write a bunch of songs really at the last second for the specific session in mind, and so that's how this record came together, for sure. So but I feel like when I do that, the songs kind of belong together,
right?
You know. Yeah.
Well, let me ask. So the liner notes I was given really are just kind of applied to the song, maybe. But it says it's engineered by Ed Stasium. Did he engineer everything on the album, or just that?
No, he mixed the record.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So it was like everything was recorded, and I felt like the record was sounding really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've been mixing all these records myself, and it's hard for me to let go of it now that I do it all the time.
Yeah.
But I thought, what would it be like if I got somebody really good who really knows how to make records? What if I got somebody like that to mix it? And, Ed Stasium was the name that always stuck in my head because I just love the records he made.
He
makes, you know, his records sound so good. And he recently had done the remix of Tim, you know, by the Replacements, which, you know, everybody was kind of controversial. You can't mess with that record or whatever, you know, but, you know, fuck that. You know, I love the original Tim. I still will listen to the original Tim, but I like his version, his mix of it too. It's awesome. It sounds fantastic. and you know, of course he's done Smithereens and Ramones and
right, a lot of Ramones,
Talking
yeah.
Heads. I mean, just he's done so many great records I love. So I thought, what would it be like if I got him to do it? And I talked to Dennis Dykin and Steve Martin of Translator, who'd worked with him too, and they said, well, you should just call him up. He's really reasonable. He's a really, really great guy and everything. So, because I'd never met him or anything, and so I just I called him up, and he was flexible with his pricing, because I thought there's no way I'm gonna be able to afford it, and you know, he was very flexible, and I was like, well, let's do this, it'll be really, really fun. And he was such a great guy to talk to. I just felt immediately at ease with him. I felt like he knows what I'm going for, and then the real kicker was when I sent him the songs, he flipped out, you know, he really loved them. You know, he's like, this is my kind of thing, you know? Yeah. So he just loved it. And so we just went through the song by song. I gave him the songs in order. I said, I already had like a track list,
order.
And
he
mixed it all. Yeah. Track order. Yeah. Sequence. He mixed it all in order and he added things to it. Cause I really specifically, I tried to keep this record really simple. I wanted it to sound pretty live because it felt so good just the way we played the songs in the studio. So I resisted overkill on it because I tend to do that sometimes. But he said, well, is it all right if I put tambourine on it? I was like, yeah, you can put tambourine on it.
Oh man, cool. always put a tambourine if you can. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. That's where I come from. I put tambourine on everything. So this song, I wouldn't allow myself to do it. I wouldn't allow myself to put tambourine on it. Cause I was like, you know, but then when he made the decision, I was like, okay, that's great. Yeah. You go for it. And there was a song I asked him to play guitar on because I couldn't, because of my stroke, I can't really do the Johnny Ramone kind of downstroke, you know, thing anymore. And so there was one song that really needed it. So I was like, can you do that? And, you know, and he's like,
Which song is that?
You know, he did that.
Which song?
Falling Like Jets.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah.
Falling Like Jets. Yeah. Yeah.
It's definitely,
and so
yeah.
He put that on there and you know, and he added some little bits to Blow in My Bag. He put some like little bells and Mellotron stuff like that. So he added little bits here and there, which was really, really, really nice, you know, but without overkill. I mean, sometimes he put stuff on that I didn't even notice. And he's like, well, I put guitar on that one. I was like, I re-listened to it. Oh, yeah, and I could hear it now. So he wasn't, like, really blatant with it, but it his little touches added a lot.
Yeah.
And basically, I mean, he'd send me a mix. I'd say, okay, this is great. Can you change this a little bit? And he was just like so amenable to everything I wanted, but I didn't have to ask much because he knows what I like, you know, he knew immediately that we're on the same wavelength, you know? And, he was just a pleasure to work with. And I actually will get to meet him. I actually haven't met him yet. We did a lot of stuff on Zoom and everything like that, but he's going to be on the Underground Garage cruise.
All right. Well, I wanted to talk about the cruise in a moment, but first I want to drill down a little more on Let the Rope Hold, Cassie Lee. So that tune, when did you come up with a song? What was the inspiration?
That was like a few years ago. I think we were playing like one song, one show in the middle of the pandemic. There was a time when it seems like things were kind of clearing up for a little while, and Steve and Linda were coming out here to visit or something, and so we felt like, yeah, I'll book a show at this little pub called the Alberta Pub. And so we booked a show there, and as it turned out, it was like kind of the one day, and then it went right back to COVID immediately right after. So it was like the only show I played in the whole, like, probably 2 or 3 years there. And I think I just thought, we need a new song, something that's really easy. We could just learn on the spot and just play. And I think I had written the lyrics. I think the lyrics and the song all came together at once, which doesn't happen very often. But I was shooting. I'm just like, I'm going to make this song the easiest song for anybody to play. And I just started singing these words, you know, and they all came to me, and they made sense to me. They don't necessarily make sense to anybody else, of course, but, and I don't even know what they mean, but they felt good to me. I wrote that song, showed it to them. We had like one rehearsal. We played at that show, and with Peter and Linda and Steve and I, and then, you know, I came back to it probably a year later when we actually had the recording session in Seattle after the Filthy Friends thing. We just threw that one down. We recorded 9 songs in that day, and that was the last one, because I left that because I knew it'd be the easiest song to do. And Peter was like done at that point. He was like, he was so fried. He's like, I've already learned 8 songs, and we just gone through playing all this Filthy Friends stuff and everything like that. And he's like, I go, just one more. It's really, really easy. We'll play it one time. And we just played it one time, and that was it.
Hey, I want to point out, I love your organ bits on that one, right? That's you playing the organ?
Yeah, it is. That was over. That was an overdub, but
right. But it's still great little parts.
But yeah, no, good. I like that. It's funny now because now I've got Debbie Peterson from the Bangles. You know, she sang on the whole record. I really like working with her, and I thought she should sing on every song on the record. So I made that happen, and then I said, do you want to go and play these songs? Do you want to go on tour? And she's like, well, yeah, but Linda plays drums. And I was like, yeah, but you know, you play guitar a little bit. She's like, yeah, I can play guitar. And then I was like, how about organ? Have you ever played organ? She's like, no, I have never played organ at all. She's never played keyboards at all, but she's going to play keyboards on the cruise and on the West Coast tour. She's going to play a lot of organ. And she came over about a week ago, and we were playing that song, and she did that, the whole, some little organ riffs and stuff in there. I was like, wow, this is great. She doesn't even know what note she's hitting, but she's got a good ear. So she's figuring out how to play organ for the -5, which is really, really cool.
Oh man. Well, there's a couple of names are getting thrown around here. I'll make sure people know who we're talking about. So when you say Steve, you're talking about Steve Wynn.
Yeah. Yeah. That was Steve Wynn, who isn't on the record, but he was there the first time we played that song.
You played a song, and Linda's his wife.
Yeah, Linda's his wife. Yeah, Linda Pittman, and they're all in the baseball project with us. So they're Baseball Project's going to play on the cruise too.
As well, and, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. And then, but the lead guitar solo on Let the Rope Hold, Cassie Lee, that is Kurt Block.
Kurt Block, yes. Yeah. He's the guitarist. He's the lead guitarist on the record pretty much.
All throughout. Okay.
And he tracked all that stuff live. And he's great, but he didn't want to go on the boat. He didn't want to go on the cruise. So he's not going to be there.
Okay. Wait, one more name, Patterson Hood. I want to ask you about Patterson Hood, because I have him listed on, I see him on a list here saying backing vocals on the Cassie Lee tune. Is that right? Is he singing on that? Does he sing on any other tracks on the album?
Yeah, he sang on Blowin' My Bag, which we came out of as a single or whatever, like in a video like 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago. So he's kind of more featured on that one. But he and Debbie do the shout-alongs on the Let the Rope Hold, Cassie Lee.
Yeah. Well, the Blowin' My Bag, curious about that tune. Any particular sort of anxiety inspire that? Or
I have no idea what was going on in that. I didn't even, you know, somebody was making a joke about it after the video came out, said something, is this about cocaine? And I was like, oh no, because I didn't even think of blow as cocaine blow. It didn't even cross my mind that it could be read that way. So I was thinking of blowing into a bag. I don't really know why. I mean, I don't know why. I don't know what it's about, but these things just come. I just get a phrase in my head and I just go with it, you know.
Well, do you have a burgundy suit?
I don't, but I did see somebody on TV talking about, is that a talk show? And I can't, it's just so stupid because I can't remember who it was, but somebody had said, you know, I bought a burgundy suit and everything, it makes everything better. You know, I just feel really, really good. And I can't remember who it was, but that's where I got the idea for that song. I just ran with that.
Well, you know what I have to say? I'll tell you what I have to say about burgundy suit. You know what I have to say about burgundy suit? Ooh la la.
All right. Well, the funny thing was, Ed Stasium said, man, I had a burgundy suit. That was like my favorite suit I ever had. So it struck a chord with him too. So that was good.
Hey, so here is a serious question. So back in, I think it was like 2017, you had a stroke. How is your health?
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. I mean, I'm doing really well. I mean, I had a operation on my heart like 4 years ago because it turned out that was what caused the stroke, is because my heart wasn't working right. It's misfiring. And so I have a fibrillation, I can't say it now. AFib. AFib is
okay.
What they call it. But it's when your heart goes crazy and it's really irregular heartbeat and all that stuff. And I was on medication to try to get it under control, and I'll be on, you know, blood thinners for the rest of my life and all that stuff. But it was kind of, wasn't really working, the drug I was taking. And so they finally convinced me to undergo a heart procedure. And I had it, I think like 4 years ago now. And it really worked really well. It's like a 50-50 chance it's going to work, but in my case, it's worked really well. So I'm knocking on wood right now. Because they say, well, if you had a stroke, you're probably going to have another one. And they say, you know, if your AFib goes away, it's always going to come back and all this stuff. So, you know, it's a little depressing to think in those terms, but in my case so far, I'm doing really, really well. I feel really good. And, you know, there's a lot of leftover things with abilities to play and the inability to remember any words to any songs, which is a real bummer for me, but yeah. But you know, I just have to have a music stand a lot of the time, and you know, just I can occasionally play a show without any cue cards or but it's very few and far between. It's like, you know, when we did the 40th anniversary of the Young Fresh Fellows first record last year, I could kind of remember most of those songs because they were just so ingrained in me, and I've been singing them for so many years that they were ones that started coming back to me after you know, I was blank, totally blank. I didn't have any words at all after the stroke. But when I started trying to get them to come back, those were the ones that would sort of appear in my brain again. But they, at the same time, they can disappear at any time. You know, I mean, I'm singing a song, I think I've sang it a million times, and sometimes it'll come out and sometimes it won't. Sometimes it just won't come, make its way through the damaged part of my brain. It's a weird thing, but you know, I'm not complaining, because man, I'm lucky. I'm really lucky, you know. So
absolutely. Well, also, so the Minus Five playing on this upcoming Underground Garage cruise, the Baseball Project, you know, featuring you and Steve and Linda, and that has Peter as well.
Yeah, and Mike Mills is in both of them. Mike's going to play some of the Minus Five set too, and John Ramberg from the Model Rockets and the Tripwires is going to play guitar. He's going to fill in for, because he was just coming on the cruise anyway, and he's been in the Minus Five for off and on for ages, so he's going to play. And I think Jason Victor will probably play on some songs too, who plays with Steve Wynn and Dream Syndicate and all that. So it'll be a little bit of a mix and match, but it'll be should be great. And then we're also playing with Lenny Kaye doing the Nuggets thing.
Oh man, that is awesome! Do you have any other? I mean, with the album coming out, is there like a summer tour planned, or any other shows happening?
The record comes out May 30th, and then we're doing the West Coast with the actual band that's on the record. So it's Linda, Peter, Kurt Block, and Debbie Peterson and me. We're going to do the whole West Coast tour. So we'll start in Pappy's and Harriet's in Joshua Tree in San Diego and go all the way up to Vancouver. So we're doing that whole thing, and that'll be really great. And then in August, we're going to play 2 weeks in the UK with Lou Kaines and Peter Buck, because we've got a new record coming out with that band too, which is me and Peter and Linda are all in that one with Lou Kaines. And so we're going to go over there, and the Minus Five will open for Lou Kaines and Peter Buck, and it'll be the same band basically. and then we're doing a Baseball Project tour in September, which will be 3 weeks, which will also have the Minus Five opening. So, you know,
wow.
it's a flexible thing, but it'll be Linda and Peter and I will be on all this touring, and we'll have kind of be swapping out lead guitar players some of the time.
All right, we're going to go out here with a tune off of Or on Penelope, the song Garden of Arden. And I mean, to me, I think like Shakespeare, As You Like It, you know, the Forest of Arden. I mean, what is the Garden of Arden? How did you come up with that?
The Garden of Arden, Garden of Arden is the place where Eve Arden lives, in my mind.
Okay.
it's about Eve Arden, who I just love her as an actress. I mean, she plays this always a wisecracking, you know, redhead in many, 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 many movies and on TV and everything like that. And I just had the Garden of Arden thing appeared in my head, and I kind of wrote the words as I was walking around one day, and it turned out to be a really cool song. So, and you know, I'm kind of damaged by Turner Classic Movies, you know. I mean, I watched it a lot before the stroke, but since the stroke, I mean, I kind of used it I just watched it like 24 hours a day with closed captions on, to try to get language going back in my head, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I having closed captions really helped, and just I just love those old movies, and so yeah, a lot of stuff from Turner Classic movies sneaks into my songs, but that was just a full on Eve Arden tribute. But you know, it's filtered by my imagination, which is so you wouldn't actually you know hear it and go, oh, this is about Eve Arden, because it could have been, like you said, like, you know, the garden, you know, like a Shakespearean thing, stuff like that. So I like to leave that stuff open, but you know, you asked, and so I'm telling you.
Yeah, now I know, and I think that's way, you know, way cooler than Shakespeare.
I like Shakespeare too.
You are, yeah, yeah. Scott, we gotta wrap up things, and I wanna thank you so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
All right, it was great talking to you, Manfred. Always.
All right, now let's hear about the Garden of Arden. It's the minus five off the new album Or on Penelope in Little Steven's Underground Garage. A bit of the Garden of Arden. That's the minus five here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to the band Scott McCoy for speaking with me on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. Singer-songwriter Jessie Wagner, now she's got a new album out on Wicked Cool Records. It's titled War Within, and she'll be my guest next time around to tell us all about it on your next Coolest Conversations presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.